It was Jordan who had suggested the motif for the mansion, a stylized representation of the stone bird from the ancient ruins of Rhodesia, the falcon of Zimbabwe. The great raptor, the pedestal on which it perched, decorated with a shark's tooth pattern, adorned the banisters of the main staircase. It was worked into the polished granite of the huge bath in Mr. Rhodes's suite. It formed a fresco around the walls of the dining room, and four replicas of the strange bird supported the corners of Mr. Rhodes's desk. The bird had been a part of Jordan's life from as far back as his earliest memories reached. The original statue had been taken by Zuga Ballantyne from the ancient temple, one of seven identical statues that he had discovered there. He'd only been able to carry one of them. He had left the other birds lying in the ancient temple enclosure and taken the best-preserved example. Almost 30 years later, Ralph Ballantyne had returned to Great Zimbabwe, guided by his father's journal and the map he had drawn. Ralph had found the six remaining statues lying in the temple enclosure of the ruins, just as his father had left them. But Ralph had come prepared. He had loaded the statues onto the draft oxen he had brought with him, and despite the attempts of the Matabele guardians to prevent him, had escaped southwards across the Shashi River with his treasure. In Cape Town, a syndicate of businessmen headed by the multimillionaire Barney Barnato had purchased the relics from Ralph for a substantial sum, and had presented them to the South African Museum in Cape Town. The six statues were still on display to the public there. Jordan had visited the premises, and spent an hour standing transfixed before them. However, his own personal magic was embodied in the original statue that his father had discovered, and which throughout his childhood had ridden as ballast over the rear wheel truck of the family wagon during their wanderings and travels across the vast African veldt. Jordan had slept 1,000 nights above the bird, and somehow its spirit had pervaded his own and taken possession of him. When Zuga at last led the family to the Kimberley diamond diggings, the bird statue had been unloaded from the wagon and placed under the camelthorn tree which marked their last camp. When Jordan's mother, Aletta Ballantyne, had fallen sick with the deadly camp fever and finally succumbed to the disease, the statue had come to play an even larger place in Jordan's life. He had christened the bird Parnes, after the goddess of the North American Indian tribes, and later he had avidly studied the lore of the great goddess Parnes that Fraser had detailed in his Golden Bough, a study in magic and religion. He learned how Parnes was a beautiful woman who had been taken up into the mountains. To the adolescent Jordan, Parnes and the bird statue became confused with the image of his dead mother. Secretly he had developed a form of invocation to the goddess, and in the dead of night when all the other members of his family slept, he would creep out to make a small sacrifice of hoarded food to Parnes and worship her with his own rituals. When Zuga, financially reduced, had been forced to sell the bird to Mr. Rhodes, the boy had been desolated, until the opportunity to enter Mr. Rhodes's service and follow the goddess replaced the emptiness of his existence with not one but two deities, the goddess Parnes and Mr. Rhodes. Even after he was grown to manhood in Mr. Rhodes's service, the statue continued to bulk large in Jordan's consciousness, though it was only very occasionally in times of deep turmoil of the spirit that he actually resorted to the childish rituals of worship. Now he had lost the lodestone of his life, and irresistibly he was drawn towards the statue for the last time. Slowly he descended the curve of the main staircase. As he passed, he caressed the carved balustrades which were worked into faithful copies of the ancient bird. The lofty entrance hallway below was floored with black and white marble slabs arranged in a checkerboard pattern. The main doors were in massive red teak, and the fittings were of burnished brass. The light of the lantern that Jordan carried sent grotesquely misshapen shadows flowing across the marble or fluttering like gigantic bats against the high carved ceiling. In the centre of the marble floor stood a heavy table, upon which were the silver trays for visiting cards and mail. Between them was a tall decoration of dried protea blooms, which Jordan had arranged with his own hands. He set the lamp of Sèvres porcelain upon the table, like a ritual lantern upon a pagan altar. He stepped back from it and slowly raised his head. The original stone falcon of Zimbabwe stood in its high niche, guarding the entrance to Groote Schuur. Seeing it thus, it was not possible to doubt the aura of magical power that invested the graven image. It seemed that the prayers and incantations of the long-dead priests of Zimbabwe still shimmered in the air about it, that the blood of the sacrifices steamed from the wavering shadows upon the marble floor, and that the prophecies of the Amlimo, the chosen one of the ancient spirits, invested it with separate life. Zuga Ballantyne had heard the prophecies from the Amlimo's lips, and had faithfully recorded them in his journal. Jordan had reread them 100 times, and could repeat them by rote. He had made them part of his own personal ritual and invocation to the goddess. "There shall be no peace in the kingdom of the Mumbos, or the Monomotapa, until they return, for the white eagle will war with the black bull until the stone falcons return to roost." Jordan looked up at the bird's proud, cruel head, at the sightless eyes which stared blankly towards the north, towards the land of the Mumbos and the Monomotapa, which men now called Rhodesia, and where the white eagle and the black bull were again locked in mortal conflict. And Jordan felt a sense of helplessness and emptiness, as though he were caught up in the coils of destiny and was unable to break free. "Have pity on me, great Parnes," and he dropped to his knees. "I cannot go. I cannot leave you, or him. I have no place to go." In the lamplight, his face was tinged with a faint greenish sheen, as though it had been carved from glacial ice. He lifted the porcelain lamp from the table and held it high above his head with both hands. "Forgive me, great Parnes," he whispered, and hurled the lamp against the panelled woodwork of the wall. The lobby was plunged into darkness for a moment, as the flame of the shattered lamp fluttered to the very edge of extinction. Then it sent a ghostly blue light skittering across the surface of the spreading pool of oil. Suddenly the flames burned up strongly and touched the trailing edges of the long velvet drapes that covered the windows. Still kneeling before the stone statue, Jordan coughed as the first wisps of smoke enveloped him. He was mildly surprised that after the first burning sting of it in his lungs, there was so very little pain. The image of the falcon high above him slowly receded, dimmed by the tears that filled Jordan's eyes, and by the dense swirling curtains of smoke. The flames made a low drumming roar as they caught on the wooden panelling and shot to the ceiling. One of the heavy drapes burned through, and as it fell, it spread open like the wings of an immense vulture. The fiery wings of thick velvet covered Jordan's kneeling figure, and their weight bore him face down to the marble floor. Already asphyxiated by the dense blue smoke, he did not even struggle, and within seconds the mound of crumpled velvet was transformed into a funeral pyre, and the flames reached up joyously to lick against the base of the stone falcon in its high niche.
"Batso has come down from the place of the Amlimo at last," Izasi said quietly, and Ralph could not contain himself.
"Are you sure of this?" he demanded eagerly, and Izasi nodded.
"I have sat at the campfires of his impi, and with my own eyes have seen him, with the bullet scars shining like medals of silver upon his chest. With my own ears I have heard him harangue his Amadoda, stealing them for the fighting which lies ahead."
"Where is he, Izasi? Tell me where I can find him."
"He is not alone."
Izasi was not about to spoil the dramatic impact of his report by prematurely divulging the bare bones of fact.
"Batso has with him the witch, who is his woman.
If Batso is warlike, then this woman, Tanazi,
the favourite of the dark spirits, is bold and ruthless, driven by such bloody cruelty that the Amadoda, when they look upon her beauty, shudder as though it is an unspeakable ugliness."
"Where are they?" Ralph repeated.
"Batso has with him the wildest and most reckless of the young Indunas, Dzama and Kamuza, and they have brought their Amadoda, 3,000 of the fiercest and finest, with Batso and Tanazi at their head. These impis are as dangerous as the gut-stabbed lion, as deadly as the old bull buffalo, circling in thick cover to lay for the unwary hunter. God damn you, Izasi, we've waited long enough. Ralph snarled at him. Tell me where he is.
Izasi looked pained and deliberately took a little snuff. His eyes watered, and he sneezed delectably and wiped his nostrils on the palm of his hand.
Gandang and Babian and Somabula are not with him.
Izaza took up his recital precisely at the point where Ralph had so boorishly interrupted him.
I listened while the Amadoda spoke of an Indaba, held many weeks back at the Valley of the Anlimo. They say that the old Indunas decided to wait for the divine intervention of the spirits, to leave the road southwards open for the white men to leave Matabili land and to sit upon their shields until these things come to pass.
Ralph made a gesture of disgusted resignation. Do not hurry in your telling of it, wise one, he encouraged Izasi with weighted sarcasm.
Do not spare us the smallest detail.
Izasi nodded seriously, but his dark eyes sparkled, and he tugged at his little goatee beard to prevent himself grinning.
The bellies of the old Indunas are cooling. They recall the Shangani and Bembezi battlefields. Their spies report that the laga here at Bulawayo is guarded by the three-legged guns. I tell you, Henshaw, that Batso is the serpent's head. Cut it off, and the body dies.
Izasi nodded sagely. Now will you tell me where Batso is, my brave and wise old friend? Izasi nodded again in appreciation of Ralph's change of tone.
He is very close, Izasi said. Not 2 hours' march from where we sit.
Izasi made a wide gesture that took in the darkened lager about them.
He lies with his 3,000 Amadoda in the Valley of the Goats.
Ralph looked up at the segment of old moon that hung low down in the sky. 4 days to the new moon, he murmured. If Batso plans to attack the lager here, then it will be in the dark of the moon.
3,000 men? Harry Mellow murmured.
There are 50 of us.
3,000. The moles, and the Insukamini, and the swimmers.
Sergeant Ezra shook his head.
As Izasi has said, the fiercest and the finest.
We'll take them, said Ralph Ballantyne calmly.
We will take them in the Valley of the Goats, 2 nights from now, and here is the way we'll do it.
Batso, son of Gandang, who had denied his father and defied the greater Indunas of Kumalo, passed from one watchfire to the next, and beside him moved the slim and exquisitely graceful figure of his woman Tanasi. Batso reached the fire and stood tall above it. The flames lit his features from below, so that the cavities of his eyes were black caverns, in the depths of which his eyes glinted like the coils of a deadly reptile. The light of the campfire picked out in harsh detail every line and crease that suffering had riven into his face. Around his forehead was bound the simple strip of moleskin. He did not need the feathers of heron and paradise widow birds to place the seal upon his majesty. The firelight glinted upon the great muscles of his chest and arms, and his scars were the only regalia of honour that he wore. Tanasi's beauty was even more poignant when seen beside his ravaged features. Her naked breasts were strangely incongruous in these warlike councils, but beneath their satiny swelling they were hard as battle-forged muscle, and the sudden thrust of her nipples, puckered and dark, large as the first joint of a man's little finger, were like the bosses in the centre of a war-shield. As she stood at Butso's shoulder in the firelight, her gaze was as fierce as any warrior there, and she looked up at her husband with a ferocious pride as he began to speak.
"I offer you a choice," Batso said. "You can remain as you are, the dogs of the white men. You can stay as Amaholi, the lowest of the slaves. Or you can become once again Amadoda."
His voice was not raised nor strained. It seemed to rumble up out of his throat, but it rang clearly to the highest part of the natural rocky amphitheatre, and the dark masses of warriors that filled the bowl stirred and sighed at the words.